Nadine, thanks so much for joining us again for this third episode. Colleagues, welcome back to this episode with Dr. Nadine Harker. I'm Goodman Sbero, the ICERP Global Scientific Advisor and your host. You can find me on LinkedIn and all the socials at the handle Prof. G. Sbero. You can find ICERP on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Just type in ICERP and you'll find us easily. We just had a really great discussion about early identification and support in the workplace. If you haven't had a chance to listen, be sure to go back and check out that episode. Today, we're going to talk about navigating the legal, ethical, and human rights dimensions of prevention and intervention work within the workplace. So Nadine, to get us started, what are the policies that every employer should have in place to address substance use and mental health in the workplace?
So, Prof. Goodman, one of the things that I think we should all understand is that the substance use and mental health policy that resides within the organization needs to fit into the regulatory framework of every country. So every country would potentially and presumably have, for instance, a Labor Relations Act, a Basic Conditions of Employment Act, an OHS Act, a Road Traffic Act. So once an organization embarks on developing their policy needs to fit squarely into the ambits of the broader national regulatory framework. For example, in South Africa, it is quite clear that if someone in the workplace presents with a substance use problem and it is known, you cannot just dismiss that employee. You need to refer the employee to employee wellness. So those frameworks are then embedded into the workplace policy that an organization would develop. But that policy that they develop does not just look at the legal applications to it, but should also include things that would relate to employee assistance programs, prevention programs, or health promotion programs that happen within the organization. Very often, if there's a zero tolerance within the workplace, because remember we spoke about safety-sensitive jobs, if an organization has that in their scope, that no amount or any traces of substances can be in anybody's body at any point in time, that needs to be embedded. And they are taken a further step. It has to be grounded in the national regulatory frameworks. One of the things about navigating the policy, the workplace policy in itself, is that at the table, when these policies are discussed and drafted, it can not only be managers at the table. Ideally, trade unions need to be represented, occupational health and safety, and any other divisions within that organization, such as HR, would have to be present because they do sit with information that can be used to flesh out components of the workplace policy. Small and medium enterprises, I'd also like to highlight, whilst bigger corporations, most of them would probably have such policy in place, but there needs to be a little bit of a push towards the smaller organizations that actually don't have these policies in place. And people are just dismissed after perhaps even just one incident of being intoxicated or under the influence when they could safely have been navigated to treatment or to other services. As far as occupational health and safety relates to all of this, occupational health and safety plays a role when it comes to certain aspects of what gets screened for within the workplace. And that can also be safely integrated into a policy to include mental health screening and substance use screening.
Nadine, workplaces vary in staff complement. So how do we go about ensuring that policies are not only compliant, but also ethical and address specific communities and needs?
It is important, Prof. Goodman, that these policies be workshopped across the organization. And by workshopping it across the organization, various voices will be heard to make sure that it is fair and supportive in its nature, that it addresses risks safely because the whole organization needs to be protected, but also safeguards the employee from being unfairly treated, and that approaches used by the organization are supportive to the individual that has a substance use or a mental health problem. And this is why I mentioned at the start that very often we see a policy as a very negative document, but a policy is meant to be protective to the employee and protective to the employer, and they feed back into each other.
Do you have any specific suggestions, Nadine, for how some of these workshopping activities might take place? Does it look like bringing everyone into a room and having a presentation? Does it look like having specific groups engaged with differentially? What's the best strategy for doing that?
The best strategy is organizations first need to commit. Committing to prevention is like getting a tattoo on your face. You have to be serious about it. So once the organization commits to a prevention strategy, they would have to embark on a universal prevention program within their organization. That is starting from the bare bones of making the policy, workshopping the policy with all staff, creating awareness around it, seeing early prevention programs, not early intervention programs, sorry, awareness programs around what is in existence for people. And built into that is destigmatizing substance use, destigmatizing, not affirming anything, but just destigmatizing that there are ways to that one can overcome, and there are ways that the organization can assist. And that is where the leadership support comes in. So off the bat, that happens together at the universal level, at the level of the entire organization. And it rides on this premise that you'd rather want to invest in the health of all, as opposed to just dealing with trying to figure out a way to put it, fighting the fire. You want to prevent those that are healthy by virtue of people living very difficult lives, as to what we perhaps 50 years ago, it was a little bit easier. But you want to create systems and mechanisms within your organization to help people cope with difficult life challenges. And the only way to do that is through consistent ad hoc, consistent, not ad hoc, committing to programs for the entire lifetime of that organization. And interestingly, I work for an organization that has now started adopting that. There's an emphasis on wellness. There's an emphasis on health. There are fitness workshops. There are lunchtime programs that are being offered that range from how you budget to how you deal with a difficult coworker, where to go should you need help for problems. But it isn't something that happens at a set time and a set place every 5 years. It's continuous, and it is this part of an agenda that the bigger organization adopted. And leaders, senior leaders, are part and parcel. I myself, if I can share, I try and attend the exercise class that happens on a Tuesday, 45 minutes. And that is what we're speaking about. It's not ad hoc. It's consistent, it's sustainable, and it's engaging. And that is how ideally at the universal or the whole organization level, you would begin to address. I think I digress there a little bit with my own little story.
Well, it's perfectly all right. So Nadine, now the organization has committed. They are very interested in having a prevention strategy. They're ready to embark. But the reality is that organizations have differing structural and operational requirements and impediments. So given that consideration, what challenges in your view do HR managers and managers in general face in implementing these policies?
I think the challenges would possibly be, from my point of view, ignorance, Prof. Goodman, not understanding. That seems to be the major barrier. The other barrier would be financial aspect to it. But if you could get a good economist involved, you'd find that for every dollar you spend on preventing poor health. Now I speak about things like NCDs, your diabetes, cardiovascular disease risks. You make possibly $1.89 back in the long term, because you have less medical costs, you have less having to replace people because they either pass away or they leave or they're on sick leave, etc. So there's a clear return on investment when faced with the question of, is prevention or health promotion worth it? But that is the barrier. The other barrier is obviously not understanding and not embracing. It's this whole concept and mind shift that needs to happen, Dr. Goodman, which I call, and I learned this actually through one of my PhD, not a supervisor, but someone that was integral to my study at the time, is we have illness, and the capital letter in illness is I. We have wellness. The capital letter there is you, and the second is we. And that is where the shift needs to happen, from not addressing the I, which is the individual in the illness, but the we towards wellness.
Nadine, great. So first of all, I'm going to have to now start also toggling between calling you doctor and Prof. Nadine, because you're putting me under pressure now. So Prof. Nadine, finally, for this particular section, how do we handle cases where substance use intersects with workplace safety?
Again, all of this rides within the policy that the organization sets. So an individual would know, and if there's an existent policy, and we're working off the premise that there's a policy, the policy would clearly state that no substances are allowed within the workplace, right? Or the policy would say there's a zero tolerance on substance use. Some organizations, you would pitch up in the morning and there are random urine analysis or random breath checks or breathalyzers for alcohol. And that is based on a policy. In the event that it is detected in your system, you would then be sent immediately. There's no informal process there again. That is straight through to a formal process where you are referred to the employee wellness service. You are then assessed and screened. It will determine whether you need further interventions. But ideally, what should happen within organizations is that regular, as part of occupational health and safety practices, that when you go for your blood checks and your cholesterol checks, that occupational health and safety practitioners also screen for mental health and substance use disorders using basic screening tools that Prof. Goodman, you are well versed with, the CIST or whatever the case may be, to early on screen for any issues, including mental health screeners. Because what we don't want is everybody wants to be alarmed when the catastrophe happens, when it could have been prevented. And that, I think, and I hope it has come through strongly, that a lot of emphasis needs to be placed on prevention, because a lot of harm can be deferred if we do that. So there is a need for brief and early interventions to check even before you are caught having had alcohol the night before and you caught at the checkpoint when you have a random test or forced test, etc. And the other issue that comes into play there is also, obviously, as part of occupational health screening, you'd also have the safety risk assessments, and those alcohol screening brief interventions can be incorporated into that space as well, which is important. But what is also of concern, and that is missing to a certain degree, is that in the event that the substance person that uses the substances has now been sent for treatment, they are back at work, that there's not sufficient accommodation being made for these individuals. So, for instance, they have come through maybe structured or unstructured program. They are in recovery. Reasonable accommodation is not always necessarily made for them at the workplace. So a missing gap is reintegration into work. And peer support and peer care becomes important there. And organizations, as part of their policy and as part of their prevention or as part of their reintegration to work program for when people come back from treatment, should actually cover reintegration of work, that is work modifications if needed or alternative work if required, to accommodate the individual for a set time as determined by the practitioner who treated them and not the supervisor, of course, and aftercare support support. I know of big organizations, I'm talking corporates, that have standing organization, standing agreements with places like AA that come to the workplace during a lunchtime, and they have an AA session there for those that are in recovery. And I see no problem with any of this, because it really just provides the next level of support an individual has. The problem has traditionally been people are sent away, they come back, they are left without any support. And you and I both know how addiction works. There's still a cycle of care that is needed beyond, and that needs to be sustained. And again, that can safely be incorporated into the policy.
Nadine, thank you. So clearly we need to really incorporate mental health screening and make sure that we incorporate screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment as a solid evidence-based strategy. And overall, you've really helped us start to think about how all these interventions are meant to drive the design of healthy work environments. And that's what we're going to be focusing on in our next session. So Nadine, thank you for giving your time for this session. Colleagues, please join us for the next session, where we are going to focus on building resilient and healthy work environments. Thank you for spending this time with us. We hope you enjoy that as much as we did. Be sure to hop on over to our website, isop.net, where you'll find information on how to sign up for free membership. Take care and catch you on the next one.